Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. This is your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim O'Shea.
Tim, great to see you today. We've got a great, great show coming up.
I'm excited for Michael Elkins, and thank you for bringing him on. And I'm excited to talk some hockey with you first, John.
I can't wait for that. You know, I always love talking hockey.
I do
want to make sure our listeners stay tuned. Michael Elkins is the founder of MLE Law. They really focus in on sports, collective bargaining agreements with the leagues. And as you know, Major League Baseball is in the middle of some collective bargaining. So we want to talk to Michael about that, but also what the heck is going on in college sports, right? With all the name, image, and likeness, and all of the dollars that are being funded now back into these college programs. So I think it was a really good time we took a look at the legal perspective in college and professional sports.
Yeah, and the great thing about Michael Elkins, John, is just how detailed he can go with speaking at, you know, different sports and different legal and contractual issues facing those sports. I'm worried about baseball. And we're going to get into that with Michael Elkins. You know, it felt like we just got through some trouble in the WNBA with not all the trouble, but contractual troubles. Now here it's coming on baseball. So not all good news, but we're going to dig into it.
Yeah, well, you brought up the WNBA. So we're going to go there. It just seems to me they can't stay out of the news for what I would call off the court topics, right? There just seems to be so much drama. First of all, as a PR guy, marketing guy, love the fact they're in the news every day. As a sports fan, it's getting old because I would rather the discussions, the focus, the conversation be about the game, the great athletes, and the competition.
Here's what struck me about the WNBA, and this was a sweet moment, but kind of startling too. You know, a few weeks ago, the All-Stars were visiting the new Obama Presidential Center, and former President Barack Obama was there on the basketball court that he has in that center greeting the players, and he saw Caitlin Clark. You know, he sought her out. He went over to her and was giving her some words of encouragement, but telling her to keep going, don't get discouraged. And in what world does a president feel like he needs to pep talk the superstar of a league? I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a sweet thing, but just not something I would have seen coming.
Well, I do think we're not going to solve all the PR issues here on Skin in the Game for the WNBA, but I do think more focus on the athleticism and the competition. And I do recommend that whoever leads PR, or if it's the commissioner of the league, do not allow players to tweet in the locker room right after games. For our listeners who don't know the whole story, Google WNBA and it'll pop up. But, you know, I do think there needs to be some boundaries from the players on what they can and cannot say, especially in the heat of the moment.
The thing is, in the end, I mean, there are players in any, and this is not just in a WNBA statement, players in any sport are employees of the team. They're representatives of the team and the league. And there are very few jobs, I can think of almost none, where you can freely, you know, sit there on your phone and tweet out about your employer and your colleagues. Growing pains for the WNBA. Again, big picture, not happy about the details, but, you know, glad they're getting attention, glad people care, and glad people can watch them go work to solve this too.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
That's the big thing.
Let's talk
some hockey. Want some good news real quick before we jump to Michael Elkins?
Yes, yes.
This is hockey, like I promised. I want your quick reaction. The Athletic did a survey of about 20,000 hockey fans. I'm going to tell you some results, John. They're going to make you smile. One of the questions, what best describes your feelings about the current state of the NHL? Nearly half the people said hopeful, and then another third said enthusiastic. Upset was like less than 1%. So good news there for hockey. Let me give you one more. Is betting on hockey a regular part of your fan experience? Only 7% yet said yes. We sit here talking about sports gaming and the adverse effects. 20,000 hockey fans are saying, most of the 20,000 are saying, I'm not doing it. You check out the survey, there's just a lot of good feelings out there about hockey, and a lot of healthy feelings about hockey too.
Tim, hockey's on a roll. The Professional Women's Hockey League, The Olympics, both men and women, teams are playing at the highest capacity inside their arenas that, you know, in recent history. This is actually a really good, I think, segue to our conversation with Michael Elkins, because so much of that is driven by the partnership between the players and the owners. The players have a vested interest because they have a revenue share in growing the game. They also have a salary cap. So any team has a chance to compete. The rules are fair. The salaries are all in line, whether you're a small market team or a big market team. Solid labor agreement. And that's why you're seeing more butts in the seats and you're seeing more interest than ever in the sport of hockey.
You know, and I've written about every major sport extensively, and I've got to say over time, you see more collegiality in pro hockey, women's and men's, by the way, than you do in any other sport. Any way you cut it, hockey's been together for a long time, and now it seems to be connecting with the fans at a really high level. So great to see.
Yeah. And with that, let's bring in our guest, Michael Elkins, the founder, partner, MLE Law. Michael, thanks for joining us on the program today.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
We're really excited to do a deeper dive on what seems to be the endless conversations about collective bargaining agreements in professional sports, and now potentially in amateur sports, as well as name, image, and likeness. But before we get into some of that, for our listeners, a little bit of background on yourself and your law practice.
Sure. I've been practicing 26 years now. Labor and employment law and sports. Sports a lot over the last, say, 10 years. I do a lot of litigation in state and federal courts, mostly in Florida. And in the sports world, I do a lot of NIL work, specifically representing NCAA athletes, mostly involved with Power Four schools, football specifically. I have started doing some basketball a little bit, but the bulk of my experience is NIL work in Power Four football. I have done a number of M&A deals, merger and acquisition deals involving teams, mostly in the soccer space. I did work on the Philadelphia 76ers sale back in late 2011, early 2012. So it's been sort of a bit of a mixed bag when it comes to sports.
Well, it seems like you picked a prime time to get involved in the employment and labor side of sports. What was the evolution for you and the firm to, you know, start to focus more in those areas the last 10 years?
So I worked at mid-sized to large Florida firms the bulk of my career. And then in 2019, I had my own firm, a different iteration of my own firm back in like 03 through 07. And then in 19, opened up my own firm and really had the opportunity to start focusing on some of the sports related issues that go with employment. People don't always think about this, but there's a natural synergy, or they dovetail together, if you will, especially in the world of NIL now with, you know, the issues about collective bargaining rights for student athletes. Are they employees? I mean, we're seeing that like every day now, right?
Yeah.
Antitrust issues. So it kind of fits naturally. I've been a big sports fan. It made sense, right? As a sports fan, to start doing sports law, which is always, you know, a lot of fun when you can merge your fandom with your business.
Michael, I've got to ask, and I say this as a sports writer who became a little less of a sports fan once I became a sports writer. Are you still as much of a sports fan now that you're working in the industry, or is it a little more work and a little less emotional connection?
That's a great question, actually. I talk about this frequently with my friends. I'm a little bit less of a fan.
Yeah.
When you get into the industry, and I think when you start to see, for lack of a better phrase, how the sausage is made a little bit behind the scenes, your fandom, I don't want to say it plummets, but it changes, especially on the football side where I do a lot of work with specific players and various NFL agents. It's different. I still watch, you know, I'm still following, but I'm following sort of half fan, half, oh, this is interesting for what's going on. And there's a part of me when you see a story come out and it might be someone you've dealt with, you're like, oh yeah, that I know what's going on here. They've, you know, so yeah, I'm not as much of a fan. It hasn't gone away, but it's different.
Yeah.
I'll say that. It's
I can
different.
So relate to that. It's like you know too much to
Right.
just let to
Yeah.
sit back and relax, right? You've got to think about it.
Like there's part of me that says, oh, okay, the innocence is gone. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. Well,
So,
it's,
good question.
yeah, Michael, I don't know if you know my background, but I've worked for directly for four professional sports teams. And then after those days,
Okay.
I represented on a marketing side four or five different teams. And, you know, people often ask me, well, who's your favorite team? I said, well, it's the one that's paying me at that time. So,
Right.
right.
Well, I mean, I've had experiences where I've got players that I've represented playing against my team. I mean, I'm not going to root against my clients. Like
Right.
that's going to happen, right? So there's a push and pull there, so, for sure.
I'll say this one rhetorically because we have some issues to talk about, you know, speaking of things that
Sure.
are thoughtful. But yeah, when you have one client playing another, what do you do with
Oh, there you go. I've had
that,
that happen a couple times.
right? Yeah.
I've had, and you root for, I just root for both of them to do well and sort of stay home
Yep,
and
they
watch it on the
do what
couch
you
and
do.
go,
Right.
want everyone to come out healthy and both play well.
So, Michael, are there issues or area of focus for you and people who do what you do that are maybe a little less on the radar but still vitally important for athletes or for teams?
I don't know if it's less on the radar. I'm always paying attention to the situation with collective bargaining for what we, you know, currently call student athletes, particularly because it changes every day. The Stanford football players just formed a chapter of the College Football Players Association, which is the group that's trying, one of the groups trying to unionize college athletes. Now they haven't filed a petition for unionization. They haven't filed a lawsuit, but that's a big moment that now we're starting to see this happen a little bit more. And I pay close attention to it because I think this is coming. I don't think it's a question of if, I think it's a question of when. Now, how it's going to shape out, I'm not sure. What we're doing today, those of us that are sort of boots on the ground in this NIL world, probably will have some ramifications for what collective bargaining might look like. And also, just need to be informed with what that's going to be. And you don't want to be catching up on that when it happens.
How much did your focus, your firm's focus, kind of change with the, you know, the impact of the House versus NCAA settlement? Was that a tipping point in many ways for what you're doing now in the college space?
It wasn't a tipping point because the deals are still coming in. The money is all still there. That's just was a restructure of how everything's being done, right? So House obviously changed process, but it didn't really change ultimate result. So what basically is happening with House is you've got these caps, right,
Right.
that are not enough. It's just not. I think it was 23 million or something like that. It's just not enough. And the schools know that. And the players know that. The agents know that. I'm not an agent, you know, I'm a lawyer, so I just help to make sure the deal is papered correctly. So what happened with House is everybody sort of just started to figure out a way to get more players in, not exceed the cap, but still get the same amount of players in, if you're following what I'm saying.
Right.
So there was a change in process, but not a change in deal making. Maybe you could say a change in deal structure for sure. It just changed the way we did things.
Right.
And there was a lot of learning on the fly. And a lot of schools doing a lot of various and different things.
Yeah. Just for our listeners, this was it, what, June of 2025, this House versus NCAA.
Yeah.
Michael, and you're the expert, but correct me if I'm wrong, it was the ruling was there was money being redistributed back 10 years to athletes, college athletes, but also, and I think as you mentioned, now there's, I guess, lack of a better term, a salary cap, if you will, that these
That's right.
colleges can pay their athletes. And yeah, anywhere between, yeah, 21 and 23 million. So again,
Correct.
just for our listeners, if you miss that monumental decision, it's
It
changed the college sports landscape in a big, big way.
was the resolution of, I think it was three basically antitrust lawsuits that were winding their way through federal court, so they combined them. The 10-year look back was the damage component of those lawsuits, and the salary cap and some of the requirements going forward, like NIL Go and, you know, the end of collectives, so to speak, was part of the resolution as well. So what are we doing going forward? So a little bit of a system in place,
Sure.
I guess you could call it regulation, for lack of a better term, going forward. But I mean, if you were a sports fan, I'm sure that you heard about the House settlement.
We're about 1 year into it, Michael.
Yep.
The best you can say right now. Where is this netting out? I mean, ultimately, is this good or is it bad for college sports?
I think it's great for college sports. Keep in mind, I represent athletes, so my views are skewed towards my clients, as they should be. But college sports has never been better. People that say, "Oh, it's ruining college sports." I get that statement all the time. It's ruining college sports, and I have a couple points to that. First of all, the product's never been better. The ratings have never been higher. And the teams that are winning were the same teams that were winning before name, image, and likeness ever came into being. So nothing's changed. People don't want to watch, say Florida versus whatever school in the middle of nowhere that's just playing to get a payday. Nobody wants to see that game. And we saw that even in the playoff this year, right? The non-Power Four schools, ridiculous. The product's never been better. The fact that the players are able to move, from my perspective, is just a marketplace acting like a marketplace should. And when people complain about that and they say, "Oh, there's no loyalty," I say to them, "What if your industry told you you couldn't move or you were regulated?" "Oh, well, that's different." It's not different. It's the exact same thing. This is a marketplace. This is an industry. And as it stands right now, there's no rules really surrounding how these players can move about. I mean, you have a transfer portal, you have contracts, you have basic contract law, and parties will have to act accordingly. But that's really no different than the legal industry, the engineering industry, the podcasting industry. You guys have your podcast. One of you got an offer from another podcast, you could jump to that podcast. You could break your contract, and whatever comes of that will come of that. Coaches have been doing this for decades upon decades, which leads me to my next point. The coaches coming out, one in particular, Nick Saban, and screaming that we need regulation, we need all these rules. Well, I must have missed all the regulation when Nick Saban jumped from school to school to school because he got better offers. So,
Right.
what's good for the goose is good for the gander. This has been a long time coming. The NCAA knew about this. They had opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to settle what amounted, the original decision that allowed for name, image, and likeness, NCAA versus Alston, right? They had plenty of opportunity to resolve that case. And as I point out to people, that was a 9-0 decision by the United States Supreme Court. You can't get the United States Supreme Court to agree that the sky is blue. And you got nine justices to say, "Yeah, guys, they have a right to earn money based on their name, image, and likeness." So, like, what are we doing, NCAA? They planted a flag on a hill that they were not going to survive on, and they kind of are still doing it. Now they're going to Congress to try to fix this situation. I think that, of course, there should be some guardrails and some rules, but the players have to be involved in that, which leads me to my last point. The common comeback is, "Oh, but there's rules in the NFL, there's rules in the NBA, there's rules in MLB." That's right. Collectively bargained rules agreed to by players' unions that represent the players. Now, some players' unions agree to crappy rules. That's fine. People make bad deals all day, every day. But there is no unionization yet in college athletics. It is a marketplace like any other marketplace. And any attempt to thwart that marketplace, in my view, would violate antitrust law. And I'll go back to my original point, the product has never been better. And I think the people that get upset are the people where they lose their player. And that you're seeing that, right? So I went to University of South Florida, go Bulls. We just lost our coach to Auburn, right? Had a great year with that coach, gone, he's gone up. That was gonna happen anyway. That's not the result of NIL. That's the system that we're in. There are haves and there are have-nots. And that's just the way it is. And that's with any marketplace. That was a very long answer.
No, great answer, which led to me to another question. Hey, we're with Michael Elkins, the founder of MLE Law. Michael, you brought up the coaching, and this wasn't on our agenda or my discussion guide, but I've always wanted to know, with the contracts with coaches, whether it's Nick Saban or Lane
Yeah.
Kiffin,
Lane Kiffin, that's a great example.
why aren't I don't understand. It's a contract.
Sure, but a lot of those contracts will have, they'll have different provisions. A lot of them will have a list of teams that they put in there initially that say, look, if this team comes calling, I can leave. That happens a lot. The other thing too is there could potentially be an agreement reached. School doesn't want to keep a coach that doesn't want to be there. I mean, put the contract aside, practically speaking, if you're the athletic director and your head coach comes to you and says, I don't want to be here anymore. I want to go to Georgia or Penn State or wherever. Do you really want to say, well, too bad, you have a contract, you have to stay? So a lot of times they'll cut a deal to let the coach out. And maybe the coach has to give up some money or maybe there's a buyout. But a lot of times the parties will just work it out because it doesn't make sense to go to litigation. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to sue the coach and get an injunction to force him to stay? That's never going to happen. But it's interesting that people seem to have no issue with the coaches doing this. But when it's the players, oh my God, the world becomes on fire. And that makes zero sense to me.
Well, I just had issue with the way and when Lane Kiffin left Ole Miss. I mean, you know, he's
Sure.
I'm just trying to think on the you know, for the players who are about to get prepared for a playoff run, and coach walks into the room and says, I'm going to the competitor. It was just a mess the way that unfolded.
I thought so. If it was
Right.
a player doing that, they would freak out. I mean, I've posted, I do a lot on social media. Whenever I post a video on TikTok or Instagram about the rights of student athletes and name, image, and likeness, 99% of the comments are how they hate the players for doing this. They hate this system. It's destroying college football. It's the worst thing ever. That's ridiculous. It's just so ridiculous. And I have to point out to people, unless you are the diehard fan, right? Who's reading about your team every day and you're listening to the Paul Feinbaum show like every single day it's on? You know, like three players on a college football team. Give me a break. You know, your quarterback, maybe a wide receiver, maybe a DN, maybe a running back. You don't know the other 96 players.
All right. Speaking, Michael, of exposure, level of different sports. So, as you pointed out, there's great opportunity and you've really carved out, a niche and a great practice in college football. You mentioned before that you've started working in basketball. Are there other college sports that where there's either untapped opportunity or growing opportunity? Are there other sports that are on your radar?
I mean, look, I think the marketplace dictates that. You see some name, image, and likeness deals in gymnastics, particularly women's gymnastics, but they're limited to certain athletes, I think. The logical one you would think would be soccer, but from my perspective, I don't know about that. I think the United States, we're behind the world in soccer, which is okay because it's really not our sport, and I don't think it's ever going to be, despite the World Cup. I don't think people are paying money to college soccer athletes because I just don't think there's a marketplace for it. People aren't watching that whenever it's on. I don't even know where you could find college soccer. So I'm very focused on football and basketball. At this point, from my perspective, I don't see too many other emerging markets unless you can get that one or two niche athletes. So like you had a Caitlin Clark, right, in women's college basketball. Paige Bueckers, another great example. I would call that an emerging market in a lot of ways, especially with the proliferation of the WNBA. But beyond that, I still think it's football, then much farther down the list, college basketball, which has its own set of problems relative to one and done and all the other things that go with that. And then everybody else, you've got one-offs within there, if that makes sense.
We've you're down there in beautiful South Florida. We're up here in hockey country. So we have seen a little bit in the name, image, and likeness in the NCAA ranks for hockey. I think Gavin
Right.
McKenna was a recent example. And as they've started now to allow OHL players to now go to the NCAA, you're starting to see a little bit there. Not to the degree of football, but
Sure.
that is something that is emerging up here.
Interesting. And I think it matters, where are schools allocating their funds, right? And that's going to be school dependent. Now you have tension at schools like, say, Kentucky. Basketball powerhouse, but competing in the SEC. So that there's a little bit of tension there. Schools like Florida, same thing, football and basketball. That changes the game a little bit.
But I do wonder, how much regional popularity of a sport plays in.
Sure.
So, in the Northeast and just frankly the North, or the personality or skill level or both of a, you know, of an athlete. And, you know, with what Caitlin Clark was able to do on the court, and same with Paige Beckers, and Paige Beckers was also, you know, a bit and remains a bit of a fashion icon too. And she became known for that, right? So how much does that play in the personality and of the athlete and the ability for that athlete to drive a big following?
I think it's a huge component, particularly in the non-football and, well, non-football sports, right? Where personality, image, ability to build a brand, which I think Paige Beckers has been phenomenal at. Now, she clearly works at it. I've followed her a little bit on, you know, her TikTok and Instagram. I mean, she's posting and she helped to build that brand, and she's amazing at what she does athletically. So if you can merge those two things, I don't know that the sport matters so much. I call it that it factor. There's not a lot of college football players that have that. Paige Beckers has it. Caitlin Clark has it. I'm trying to think other people in history who had. LeBron James, I think, has always had that. Just there's that intangible thing that you can't really put a finger on. Look, the Cavender twins, who were pioneers in the name, image, and likeness world in women's college basketball, they were good at their sport, but they weren't Paige Beckers good. They're not playing in the WNBA that I'm aware of anyway, but they had some sort of it factor that worked. So I do think ability to build brand and understanding, you know, modern media matters for college athletes, particularly ones that are not in college football.
You had mentioned, Michael, that college basketball is facing some challenges. And for people who aren't aware, but might have caught that, walk us through what some of those are.
Well, I think you have massive dilution of the regular season. I just don't know that a lot of people are watching college basketball before the tournament as they used to. I certainly, and this is a bit anecdotal for sure, but I was, as a kid, you know, I was following all sports, and even a kid growing up in Rhode Island and in the Northeast, I mean, we had Providence College, which led me to investigating and learning about college basketball. But, you know, Louisville, Kentucky on a Saturday, regular season, Duke, North Carolina. I mean, that was prime time appointment viewing pre-tournament. Right now, I'm just not aware of people even talking about it. I also think the expansion of the tournament I don't think that's helped college basketball at all. We're seeing this with the World Cup too, that's talking about expanding the World Cup. I know they're two totally different sports, but I think when you expand tournaments like that, you dilute product. So I think college basketball has that issue. And of course, the one and done. I'm an advocate for that because it helps my clients, right? If they want to leave early, that's a good thing. But the one and done, I think, has caused some issues because you don't have teams together for very long, at least not your major teams. I think college basketball has faced some real challenges in those areas.
Yeah, man, talk about something that would get in the way of being a fan too. You know, you've got a team you love, and as a representative, yeah, you're thrilled if that guy can jump over to the NBA, right?
Sure.
But if you're following the team, you're like, no, man, stay. Yeah. So yeah, you can see that.
Yeah,
you
know,
for sure.
Michael, I would agree with your hypothesis on the delusion, and that's what'll be really interesting to watch what happens in the college football side when they continue to expand the playoff format. Because again,
which I'm against.
Good, you and I agree on that, because you know you're talking to a Buckeye here, and there's something really special about that Michigan Ohio State game and Oklahoma Texas. You know, we can go on and on. There's something on the line for every one of those games in that regular season. You know, the top 24 teams get into the playoff, those games become a lot less meaningful.
I mean, that is truly the beauty of college football, that those games every Saturday matter. But I think if you expand it, I think it's going to have a negative effect. Now, do I think people are going to stop watching football? Football in general, college or NFL, seems to be immune from any of these things. It seems like people cannot get enough of it. I wonder how that's going to play out with the NFL as it continues to expand, right? Now you can get NFL games not every night of the week, but we're getting pretty darn close, right? But college football, to expand the playoff, and I know why they're going to do it. It's the answer to all your questions is money. But I do think you're going to have an issue there with diluting the regular season and diluting the product. We'll see.
Yeah. Wanted to talk big picture. We've talked a lot about college sports and name, image, and likeness and kind of the state of the state there, but kind of taking a step back from your perspective, I want to get a sense of what you're seeing and hearing with the professional leagues and their collective bargaining agreements. Who's doing it best as far as, you know, working together, and who's not? And then we'll dive a little bit deeper specifically to talk Major League Baseball.
I don't think any of them get along too well. There's always labor strife. I mean, that's the nature of labor law, whether it's professional sports, or I do a lot of labor law, you know, just with cities and municipalities in local in Florida, you know. In terms of who's doing it best, I think you got to look at the relative deals, right? So the MLB Players Union has traditionally been the most powerful sports union that I'm aware of, right? There's still no salary cap. The players get basically are in control and get everything that they generally want, right? And the owners this year now, we're looking at a potential work stoppage, whether that's a lockout or a strike. Owners seem to want, or not seem, have come out and basically said they want a cap. They tried this in 1994. We saw what happened. It's interesting in baseball because baseball was a sport that I think had some problems and is starting to, not starting, but is on that upswing, sure, coming back, at least regionally. Like regionally, it's never been more popular. Attendance is up. Regional TV ratings are up. It's not America's pastime anymore. People don't watch the World Series or the playoffs like they used to, but regionally they do. I think a labor stoppage, I don't know, it would be the death for the MLB, but it's going to be a big problem. So we'll see what happens there. National Football League, the players union, a little bit weaker over the years. You know, players are getting more guaranteed money. The salary cap is dramatically increasing, and that's largely due to just the absolute massive popularity of the National Football League, which shows no sign of slowing down. Cap seems to work, right, in the NFL. Some people, I think, miss the days where you could have, like, dominant teams, but, hey, the Patriots were able to do it for 20 years, so everybody else probably should be able to, too. And then I think the NBA is interesting because this second apron thing that I don't know the second apron too well, but it's as I've seen it, it's causing NBA teams that built through their own players to have to basically trade away players. We just saw this with the Celtics. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Yeah,
it seems like you should be rewarding teams for building and keeping their own. So I don't know if they're doing it right, because I think parity is great, but breaking up teams that have drafted and cultivated their own players, and if those players become superstars and you need to pay them, feels like there should be a way to make that work. And then the NHL, I think, sort of sits, I know you guys are in hockey town, but yeah, the NHL, I think, sits sort of aside from the other three.
Yeah. What are you hearing on the WNBA side of things? Because it seems to be more things are talked about off the court these days than on the court.
I was just having this conversation this afternoon. I don't know where they are on their negotiating. I know the commissioner's facing a lot of turmoil. And then you've got all these players that apparently are going after Caitlin Clark. And I don't have a lot of information on all that, but I will say this about Clark. Caitlin Clark is the best thing that ever happened to the WNBA. But every great player needs a villain. Iron Man had Thanos at the end, for to bring in a Marvel reference, right? And Caitlin Clark has a number of villains. And like it or not, the WNBA is in the news. They may be in the news for being off the court, but they're in the news. And I think that's a good thing for the WNBA. I'll use the Patriots analogy. As they won more, they became villains themselves. And you had all these scandals. Those were the best things that could have ever happened to the National Football League. With those personalities, right, Brady and Belichick and all the scandal that went with it, it was everyday news fodder. I think the NFL sat there smiling the entire time. And I think some of that's true for the WNBA. I think Caitlin Clark as the face of it, and then all these players that seem to want to take her down. Look, Michael Jordan had the Jordan rules, right? The bad boy Detroit Pistons. And that was a story forever when I was a kid. So, you know, Bird versus Magic, right? I mean, you need that. I think the WNBA is going to be fine. They're going to have to figure out some of their labor issues, but I think it's a good thing that there's some villains out there.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to a video I saw a few days ago of Barack Obama greeting the WNBA All-Stars at his presidential library. He saw Caitlin Clark sought her out. You know, Caitlin, he wanted to reassure her.
I think she's going to be just fine.
I would imagine she's I would imagine she is doing just fine too. I want to ask you about the NFL and specifically the NFLPA. You mentioned that, you know, they traditionally, or at least over, you know, over the years, the NFL Players Association has been one of the weaker unions, at least, you know, compared to MLB and some other organizations. Tell us a little bit more about why, and you know, if I don't know that that's changing, but is it changing?
I don't think it's changing, and I definitely have some thoughts on why. These are my thoughts, again, anecdotally, but unions have to deal with this, but oftentimes a lot less so than what you have in the National Football League. When you're dealing with like a police union or a fire union, most of the people there are in the middle. So they can come to a consensus because their rights, generally, they're all on the same page, right? And they get affected mostly the same way. Not perfectly, but everyone is generally in the same bucket. But the National Football League is not like that. The National Football League, most players don't make it to a second contract. So the union membership turns over dramatically every single year. And you really do have a group of players that are the haves, which are much smaller, and then a group of players that are the have-nots, which is most of the league. And the leverage for a players' union is playing. And the problem for the NFL players' union is they cannot, from a group standpoint, withstand a work stoppage for very long. Those guys need to get paid. People think, oh, they're athletes, they make so much money. Not the rookies, not guys on their first contract. They do make a nice, healthy salary. They spend it too, and they can't afford to not work because their careers are so short. And so the players' union, from my outside looking in, has this issue of trying to deal with this mass turnover every year, and then the threats of work stoppages are really problematic for them. Those guys need to get back to work because their membership needs to get paid. They're not all Patrick Mahomes or Drake May or, you know, whoever. It's those are the haves, and they're much, much smaller. That's the problem that the NFLPA seems to always face. And that's why they've taken deals that were not necessarily the best, because they had to get their membership back to work. It's tough. That is just a unique situation with that kind of turnover.
We're here with Michael Elkins, the founder of MLE Law. Michael, we had an interesting conversation on Skin in the Game. It might have been almost a year ago. We had Demoris Smith on the program.
Yeah, and it was earlier, for people who want to look it up, early 2026.
Great conversation. Yeah. You know, this was great guy, smart guy. The book he wrote was great, but the stories he told us off the record were even better.
Wish we could share. But the book is called Turf Wars. And I got a sense, and I want to ask you about this, Michael. I mean, first of all, from Demoris, we got more than a sense. This is what he said. It was not his word, but this was a message. The NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, and the owners very much come across in his book as that villain, as that enemy. And again, I don't think those are the words he uses, but he uses every possible way you could think of describing it to say, to put the NFL owners in a box of people, you know, who are wealthy, greedy, out of touch, you know, and his, no surprise, you know, with where Demoris is coming from, really paints the players as a group as a group of more sympathetic young athletes who are, you know, Tom Brady's aside, trying to make their way, right, and build something. I mean, does that resonate, though, with what, you know, when you talk to clients, that's what you're seeing?
It
Not
completely
to ask too
resonates.
Loaded a question there.
No, it's a great question, and it does resonate completely. So everyone sees Mahomes, Drake May, Brady, Manning, right? That, and the NFL does a phenomenal job. First of all, it's the best marketing group, arguably, in the world. Let's start there. The National Football League. And they are smart to market the top players, of course. And that's what everyone sees. But what you don't see is how absolutely unforgiving that business is. And I deal with a lot of players. I represent some very high-profile NFL players, but I represent also guys that are just third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, or UDFAs, right? And those guys are trying to make it. And man, if you get injured, you're done. If you're no good to the team for some other reason, you're done. It is extraordinarily unforgiving. Now, a lot of people will say, well, this is the life they chose. I don't disagree with that, but it doesn't make it any less unforgiving. I do agree with the sentiment that ownership, these owners are largely out of touch in a lot of ways. I mean, this issue about the grass is kind of the best example.
Right.
I mean, you got to be kidding me. You just installed grass in all of your, not all your stadiums, but a large amount of them to appease FIFA. You claim to be worried about the health and safety of your players. I don't know that it's disputable that grass is much safer than turf. I feel like that's kind of been decided. And they're just not going to do it. Going back to the turf because it saves money.
Well, not only are they not going to do it, they're going to tear out the
They're
grass to put
tearing
the
up
turf
the
back in.
grass. I know it's wild. And you just kind of look at that and go, wow. I mean, it really is all about every single solitary dollar. And I think the owners, look, they didn't get to be billionaires because they're not smart, right? None of them are lucky. There's no lucky billionaire out there. They know the game and they know the leverage play. And the leverage play, it's not like secret. The union, these players is majority of players that are going to be on one contract, maybe a second one, and they need to play to earn a living, period. They just can't withstand a work stoppage, not for any real length of time. And I think they'll do everything they can to put the players in situations that are most advantageous for ownership, not players.
So, Michael, as we wrap up here, first of all, I want to thank you for your time and your insights. You know,
Thank
just a
you.
question for you is, is there something on the horizon that the average fan, our average, the listener should also be on their radar? What are you following?
I don't know if it's not on anyone's radar. It's baseball, and it's is there going to be a work stoppage? Really interesting because I think baseball has really gained a lot of traction. They're starting to market better. The MLB Network, I think, has won Emmy Awards as one of the best sports networks. So they've got all this momentum. They're streaming on Peacock now. The games are accessible. But this labor dispute is hanging right there. And you've got to wonder, are ownership and player and labor really dumb enough to go through another work stoppage? Do they not remember what happened in 94? And I know you guys got to go, but very quickly,
No, but
they
please.
ruined, arguably at that time, which was probably one of the best baseball seasons ever being played. You had the Yankees. People forget that 94 Yankee team was dominant. But more importantly, the 1994 Montreal Expos might have been one of the best baseball teams ever put together, and they ruined it. We never got to see it. That is what I'm paying attention to. I'm not involved. I don't do any work in baseball. I'm not involved. I'm following that as a labor lawyer and as a fan, but I definitely think fans should be paying attention to that just to see if everyone understands history should not repeat itself.
Right. So just for an update, and maybe you have a little more insight into this, I've seen the owners have submitted maybe one or two proposals. Has there been any dialogue back from the players' union?
The only thing I've seen are some reports that the owner proposals include a cap and the players have said, we are not agreeing to one. That's what I've seen. Now, I'm not on the inside. This is just stuff I've seen on the internet. So there could be other stuff out there that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, no, I
But
think
we'll
you're right.
see.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's the it's the it's they're at a standstill, so that's not a good sign.
And I read some reports that it was sort of hanging over All-Star weekend and it's hanging over the trade deadline. Teams are thinking, do I really want to get a rental player if I'm not going to have them next season? I mean, I understand a rental sometimes is for this year, but if you've got someone who's maybe got a year left on their deal, you're not going to have them if there's a work stoppage the
Right.
following year. I just, what happened in 94 was tragic for sports, tragic for the city of Montreal, too, by the way. I know you guys are up near Canada.
Well, I'm.
Yeah, I remember it
No, you
way
remember it, but
too well. And talk about not being a fan.
yeah.
That's when I stopped being a baseball fan of a
There you
specific
go.
team, which, by the way, Larry Walker, Montreal. That was my team back then.
Pedro Martinez.
Yeah.
People forget Pedro was on that team. I mean, that team was unbelievable anyway.
Well, Michael, we're going to leave it at that. And we're also going to leave it in hopes that these two sides can come together, because I'm with you. Baseball has, you know, wind at its back right now. The international game, the World Classic tournament was epic in many ways.
They finally got it together.
Let's hope. Just as you said, you know, both sides wise up and get back to the table.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, gentlemen. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks. Appreciate
the
time.
Thanks,
Michael. Tim, we didn't cover half of the things we wanted to cover because, you know, we went so deep in some very important topics.
Yeah, that was a fun conversation. And I'm looking here at this note sheet, John, that kind of guides the conversation. If anyone ever needs proof, we don't stay on script. You're right. Half of this is not. I check things off as we go.
Right.
Half of it's not checked off, and a whole lot of other notes. Yeah, I mean, what jumped at you, though? I mean, there was so much.
Obviously, Michael represents the players. And in this case, we're talking about name, image, and likeness. So his job is to represent and get the most for, you know, his clients, in this case, the players. So, you know, he's a big fan of the changes and obviously the players getting paid now in college. There's a counterpoint to that, which I think we want to get Michael back on the show as we get closer to football season, because, you know, there are negative effects with smaller mid-size programs, right? How do they compete? And then I thought was really interesting was the conversation about, you know, where he sees college basketball and how it's, you know, just maybe a bit too diluted, which I agree with. It'll be interesting to see how that also affects college football, which is now expanding its playoffs, which minimize the importance of the regular season.
Do you ever get the sense that, well, in this case, college leagues, but in general, sports leagues look at the NFL and see, you know, that's become a year-round, highly event-driven appointment. All sports is appointment viewing, but nothing, there may be nothing that is more appointment viewing, you know, on a regular basis than an NFL game.
Right.
I mean, do you think there's a little bit of different leagues trying to emulate the NFL?
Well, I think it's yes, but it's also the TV networks are driving so much of this. And the TV networks are driving it because sports content, because it is live, is really the only remaining appointment viewing out there, right? You can DVR or stream or whatever, right? Anything else. So sports live content is king. So these TV networks and now these streaming services, be it Apple, be it Paramount, are, you know, paying these fees. They want more games. If they want more games and they're willing to pay more for the games, the leagues are going to say, sure.
Yeah.
How many more do you want, right?
All right, do a 101 for everyone out there, John, though. They're paying a ton of money. How do they make money?
Yeah, well, just look at Amazon Prime is probably the best example, right? Amazon Prime has the exclusive Thursday night NFL game. The only way to watch that game is to become an Amazon Prime subscriber, right? So that's the hook. Now, granted, you can cancel those subscriptions 3 or 6 months down the road, but I don't know about you. A lot of times I forget to cancel those subscriptions.
Oh, my wife and I have a list of subscriptions we need to go through.
Right.
You know, because a bunch of $12 subscriptions add up over the course of, you know, many months.
But look at it now. Netflix live sports, YouTube live sports, Paramount Plus live sports. ESPN now has its own streaming service that's beyond the traditional cable package. So people are paying, you know, anywhere between $6.99 to $29.99 a month to get these services. And it's that sports fan, they're signing up for the subscription. That's what's driving the revenue.
Yeah. It was interesting to talk to him, you know, across different sports, but again, particularly football. Where does that revenue go? I feel like we often look at the NFL as having, you know, if you're a fan, the ideal CBA, because there's a salary cap that keeps some parity amongst teams, revenue sharing, which keeps some of the smaller markets, you know, like Buffalo, Jacksonville.
Sure.
Right. Green Bay has a different financial model, but certainly Green Bay and others, it keeps them, you know, financially solid, right? So in terms of parity in the NFL and having a good competitive, the chance to have a good competitive team every year, it's great. You know, but hearing him, he talked about the human side of all this too, which is, you know, given that football is a violent sport, with a lot of players shuffling in and out, you know, high number of injuries, but also a high number of guys coming in, a large number of guys coming in each year to replace people.
Right.
A lot of these players don't last long.
No.
And that's why you see agents and other representatives pushing so hard for the money.
Yeah. Right? I mean, you know, we always know the players, be it the Josh Allens or, you know, the Jim Kellys who have 10, 15 year careers. That's the exception. Most players are in the league for a year and a half. It's almost two separate classes of players, the marquee players and the player that's just trying to play for a paycheck, right? We brought it up on the interview with Michael. You know, go back, and if you do have a chance, any of our listeners, to go back and search that Damaris Smith episode.
Oh, find it.
That may have been... Yeah. One of our finest works, because he was just such a great guest and such an absolute wealth of information.
Yeah.
And just real quick, back to the whole college landscape, you know, and I guess I'm more of a traditionalist. So, you know, fewer games that mean more is important to me as a fan. I would love to see some guardrails, though, on kind of this whole transfer portal. I agree players should be able to move, but, you know, if you've got somebody dangling a check, you know, is your motive to move, you know, there's a counter to that as well. You know, being part of a program, growing with a group of teammates, there's value to that. So, you know, maybe there's some boundaries, you know, maybe it's a 2-year commitment to a school. And by the way, I think that should also apply to the coaches. Just because the coaches can leave every year, you know, doesn't mean the players should. I'd rather make sure the coaches stick around.
Oh, for sure.
And have some penalty for leaving these kids and leaving these players hanging.
I was glad you brought that up, John, in our conversation. You know, and I look at it too, as I'm sure you do as a parent. I project into it, and I look at it as someone who's worked in education for a long, long time.
Right, if you transferred schools just from a learning perspective every year, you're starting over.
Or if you're your teacher, your coach, your leader, is prone to leave just as quickly or nearly as quickly as you are, that can get really out of hand. When you're a kid in college, go to school and go play, you know, play your sport, have that college experience. And I mean, if you're going to transfer, you can't, you shouldn't stop it. But doing it every year or multiple years, just jumping school to school, I question the overall value of that for the individual and for the team.
And who's making that decision? Is the kid making the decision? Is the agent making the decision, or is, you know, the parents? There's other influences, and yeah, it would be good if there were just a little bit less of that, you know, in
some guardrails.
Some guardrails. So it's gonna evolve, which, by the way, is why we need to bring Michael back as a guest. So
all for that. So I'd have him back anytime.
So this fall, as college football's in the middle of it and basketball starting up, I think we should dedicate a full episode just to where the whole NIL, name, image, likeness, has evolved to at that point.
For sure. I would look forward to it. By the way, Damaris, since we're planning in front of everybody here, Damaris Smith.
We got to get him back too.
So
and we got to get him back.
Damaris, I know Damaris listens at times. So Damaris, we'd love to have you. Text me. We'll text you.
Well, hey, thanks for listening to another episode of Skin of the Game, and we look forward to catching up with everybody again next week. Skin of the Game is a production of Buffalo, Toronto Public Media. You can catch up with all past episodes on btpm.org or on the Buffalo, Toronto Public Media YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.